It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Man, I'm so glad that you guys are here. It's going to be a great show. Excited about our guests today. And you know what? I'm also excited because I'm at the tail end of my cold. I've been fighting this cold for really just a week. But, you know, when you're fighting a cold and you're in that fog of congestion, it seems to go a lot longer than you think. So a week feels like a month. And anyway, so bear with me as I get through the last bit of my cold. So if all of a sudden there's a longer pause than you think is required, or maybe there's an awkward silence, it's because I pushed the cough button and I am coughing and just muted myself out. So no big deal. Looking forward to, the show today. But before we get started, I did want to talk about this because I think this is so important. We're still here in January. Donald Trump is, up and running. We're just, it's a new start is all I'm saying. Right? Doesn't really have anything to do with Donald Trump, but my thought is this. Look, the statistics show that 95% of us give up on our resolutions or our new goals by this time every January. So where are you? I'm going to stick it to you. I'm going to hold you accountable. Why? Because look, Money for Lunch is not only about improving your life, but improving your business. But let me rephrase it. Money for Lunch is not just about improving your business, but also about improving your life. So let me hold you accountable and ask you to, if you've fallen off the goals wagon there, get back on it. Look at the stuff that you want to get done. Maybe it just needs to be revamped. Maybe it's not motivating enough. Maybe it's not clear enough. Clarity is power when setting goals. Did you know that? So the clearer your goal is, the more motivating it becomes. For example, if you say, hey, I want to take a great vacation, that's not very clear. It's not very motivating because it's so vague. But if you say, listen, I want to take a first-class vacation to Hawaii, and so then you want to go and research what a first-class vacation, let's say to fly first class from your city to Hawaii may cost a couple thousand dollars, and to stay at a first-class resort may cost you another $4,000 or $5,000. Now you know that you need $7,000, and get online, take a look at that wonderful resort you're going to be staying at, check out the sites, and get clear as to what you want, and I guarantee your motivation will come back. And then it always helps to write it down and look at it on a regular basis. If you can, cut out some pictures of a tropical, of a Hawaiian beach, and, you know, put it on your mirror. Put it in your car, put it on your notebook, put it at your cubicle or at your office, wherever you are. And it's constantly reminding you, and the beaches of Hawaii are calling you. And anyway, so I just want you to do that. I want you to think about your goals. If you've forgotten about them, it's because you need to take them, write them down, and put them in multiple places. Check your goals on a regular basis, daily. If you check your goals on a daily basis, you are happier, you stay on track, and it also repels the things that may distract you. All right, that's just my little tidbit for today. And now, speaking of engagement, let's just jump into our first guest today, Dr. John Fuller. Dr. John Fuller is the current Chief Engagement Educator for the Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Employee Engagement Services. Man, What a mouthful that title is. He's also the former director of workforce diversity at EEO for the Johns Hopkins Hospital and Johns Hopkins Health System Corporation. During his last tour of duty in the military, he was a senior Army advisor and race relations instructor for the Department of Defense Equal Opportunity Management Institute. Dr. John Fuller, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, glad to be here today with you.
Absolutely, man. I'm glad to have you here. And, you know, it's I'm very impressed, first of all, that the Department of Veterans Affairs actually has a chief engagement educator. That just seems like, you know, almost kind of like fluffy, almost a woo-woo type of program there at the Department of Veterans Affairs. So I'm glad that they have this. This is an awesome idea. I did not know you guys did this.
Yeah, well, when you finish next to the last of the best places to work in the federal government, they realize that engagement of all employees is really important. You know, it doesn't seem to be enough for some people to say that treating our veterans is, you know, the higher calling, which it is. But when you have about 30% of Americans in all occupations not being engaged with their jobs, and another 30% just basically showing up and sleepwalking throughout the day, it is an important aspect of work. Having that engagement, feeling good about what you're doing, and being able to have crucial conversations, which is what I hold across the country, it really makes a difference in the workplace.
Sure, sure. Well, you know what? It makes sense, especially, you know, at the Department of Veterans. I mean, first of all, this is a massive department. It's gotten a lot of bad press the last couple of years. So I think it's probably more important than ever to get people engaged and, you know, feeling good about what the great work, the important work that they're doing.
Yeah, we have 360,000 employees, really decentralized.
Wow.
In well over 140 medical centers, hospitals across the country. So you have different cultures, different backgrounds that are in each facility. And, of course, the veterans and their families themselves, you know, coming in, they a lot of times represent different backgrounds and cultures and age groups. And I'm a 26-year retired military. So it really is close to heart to me to make sure that every veteran that walks through the door is treated with respect. But the most important thing that we can do is have our employees treated with respect. For management, yeah. From senior leaders and that. So that's really the most important thing, using the Wegmans supermarket and others' philosophy, is that you treat your employees first. They're going to, by projection, treat their customers a heck of a lot better. And, you know, they always say customer first. Well, really, it's your employees first, because if you make them feel like they're the most important people coming to that job, they are going to project that. But if you do not do that, they're also going to project the other. So we're using that philosophy to make our employees first. By doing so, veterans will be the number one priority for those employees.
I love that. I love that. And you know what? And it makes sense, because really your employees are your first customer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I like
they're,
that.
They're a major stakeholder. They're a major stakeholder for sure. And every Fortune 500 company realizes that, whether it's making sure their pay is where it should be, doing market analysis on that regard, promoting people, giving them the opportunities. Those are the engagement factors. Most people, the number one thing that employees want is respect. They'll even pass up a promotion to get more money. And it's not always just the upward and onward type of thing. People will, you know, if they're respected for what they do and have the autonomy to do it, then they're going to want to come to work. If they're micromanaged,
yes.
If they're told, hey, you're not doing great or whatever, and really just breaking down the psychological safety throughout the workplace, you're going to have decreased productivity. And, you know, I know your show focuses on you know, business for lunch and all that. Well, that is business. I mean, if you are
right.
Affecting employees to that degree, then they are not going to do their job as effectively as if they were treated properly.
Well, absolutely. Look, you just said it. If 70% – no, what was it? I'm sorry. 30% of all employees across the board are disengaged. They're, as you, what did you say, walking in their sleep kind of a thing?
Yeah.
I mean, that is business. That means that that if those people didn't show up, you probably wouldn't notice the effect, and that means they're costing you money right now.
That is correct. You know, and you can see that on Pew Research and Gallup polls. They actually have daily tracking polls on engagement. And you really only have about 15 to 16% of people that are actively engaged. And what that means is that they're not only coming to work and doing their job, but they're looking for ways to do it better. And that's the innovation that has to drive the train out there for all businesses and also for the VA. We've improved over the past year because we had some people that were turned loose, and they were able to redesign systems and redesign things for veterans and not have these secret patient waiting lists that everybody's heard about and try to uncover those things and decrease the number of claims that we have from hundreds of thousands down to almost 40,000 now. So a lot of great things have happened, but it's because we had our employees be actively engaged and gave them the reins to do it. That is key.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this because, you know, when we start talking about employee engagement and specifically you as a senior Army advisor, you worked in the race relations department there. And so is race or races, because we have now a more diverse Army or more a diverse military than ever before, is that an ongoing thing? Talk about what's happening there.
Well, in the military, you know, I was the senior advisor to the Equal Opportunity Institute there. That was created in 1971 out of necessity because there was so much racism that was going on at that point that ship stopped, and it was during the Vietnam time, and tanks in Germany. They said, look, we're not even going to get in the tank because there's so much racism here. So that was called the Race Relations Institute, and it started out of necessity because they had to have that. But because of that, the military has really had a jump start on corporations and other industries that finally jumped on the diversity and bandwagon later on in the later 80s, saying, oh, yeah, maybe this is a good idea for our bottom line here. I mean, why do you think banks, when you go to an ATM machine in most major cities, has multiple languages on there? Because
sure,
they want customers from those backgrounds. And there was a business-driven decision to have that. It wasn't the feel-good decision. It was more, hey, we need to be able to open this up because we're going to get more people deposit money in our banks or shop at our stores. So that's where the military had a really big head start on developing great diversity-type programs, although they didn't discuss race relations the way that it should, and neither do corporations now. And that was part of my book that I wrote about challenging diversity education, was that when education started, they excluded white males from the process. And it was pretty much the blame was going that way. So if you were the one caused the problem, so you therefore cannot be an instructor, you can't be an EEO person, equal opportunity investigator, those things, because you don't know what it is to be discriminated against. So as a white male myself, that was a major challenge for me. Even though I've worked in all of these higher-level institutions, I'm really an anomaly. In the VA, the Veterans Administration, for instance, I'm the only white male out of 30 that does this type of job. So, I mean, if you're going to have diversity, then you need to start in the profession itself. And I think that that's what's going on, and businesses need to realize that too, that they need to change their modus operandi and how they do this. I do straight talk on my presentations and race relations, and we really get down. Even such things that I've went on recently with the election results and that, I get calls from all over the country from VA facilities saying, when can you come out? Because our facility right now has a lot of tension going on, and it's because of the election results and people not really knowing how to start this conversation. So they just keep it in. And if we think people check their emotions at the door, we're naive because they don't. And it does affect your business. And you know, the same thing is happening in business, too. So realize that's why I created it.
Yeah, no, I love this. And so, you know, what's interesting to me is something that you said there, that this whole thing about race, we don't know how to discuss it. We don't know how to bring it up.
Right.
And I think it's funny. It's kind of funny that, you know, here we are, we're going to be talking about diversity and they're going to exclude white or white males. That's hysterical. That's like saying, hey, we have to become more sensitive to women, and but women can't be part of the discussion. So,
right.
That just doesn't make sense. I mean, if you're going to be talking about race and diversity, then everybody should be included. Otherwise, you're already starting, we'd call it in the negative there, so to speak. So let's talk about race and the election, since you brought that up. So what do you see happening? What do you think is race or racism? Is that being affected? Is that something that Trump has made better or made worse? Or are people just sitting back waiting to see what happens? Give me your thoughts on this.
Well, when I have the race relations dialogue, and I've had them in major cities now, from St. Louis to Detroit and Philadelphia, and that what is in this country is what I call a caldera of race issues that really have not been discussed amongst the races. Once in Ferguson, where I had people that lived in Ferguson and attended the very first race relations dialogue last year with me, they said that was the first time they ever sat down with different races and discussed what the issues were in their life. And they had worked at the VA facility there, which is right down the street, for over 20 years. So all of these things that they felt comfortable talking about, and most people do, once you get them started, all the races, they'll talk like they've known each other for years. But they don't know where to start. They're too scared to start it. And if there's something that went on, such as even Representative Lewis doing what he's doing now, that's going to be an issue next week when I have another dialogue set up. So those things are really not discussed to the extent, and they weren't for decades, and they just went underground. When Dr. King was assassinated, those dialogues quit. So you had civil rights activists like Jesse Jackson and others that decided to go another route, and they went the route of the pretty much victim mentality, it's everybody else's fault, and those type of things. You know what? That's fine to point a finger, but if you're going to do that, then you need to come up with some solutions, and that's what dialogue is about, people working together. This is just not a hold-your-hand sing-along that we do in a dialogue. We are working on some issues. My very first question I asked is, like, why do we need a national conversation on race? I've heard that throughout my 27-year career in this business, and nobody's ever started one. So I did. It's the very first one in the federal government. Why did it take me to start this? You know, but I said, I've had enough. So those issues haven't been discussed, and we put them on the table. And then things like police relations and white privilege and those type of things come up after you ask just a general question. And then people start to get the moments that I look for. It's the responses of, I didn't know that. I was not aware of that. Now that I know, I got a little bit different attitude. See, those are the type of responses that I get. And every person that's attended, hundreds so far, have said to the letter they will attend the next one, and they also felt the most comfortable in their life talking about these issues. And that's going to allow them to have the psychological safety in their business and in treating our veterans the right way, because they're going to know how to act in a crucial conversation. So has race relations really been discussed over the past 30 years? No. We've had diversity classes, feel-good classes, sensitivity classes, all of these things. Those are kind of like little Band-Aids over a major wound, and it really was not working. And right now, 70% of the American population says that there's a race relations issue. It did not improve during President Obama's, and he even admitted it just last week. He says that was an unrealistic expectation. Well, you know what? He's maybe right, maybe wrong, but it didn't happen. So we're still dealing with the same 50, 60. Now it's 70% because of all these tragic events that's happened over the past couple of years, from Ferguson on in. Those in and of themselves wouldn't have created the type of protests that went on. Those other things were underneath the surface.
Right, right. All right, so when, because you said this a couple of times, you know, there are certain issues, or you mentioned issues, and so what are some of the issues that you hear about or that you face on a regular basis when it comes to race relations?
Well, I think any time that something happens with a policeman shooting an unarmed black man, for instance, that will come up. But then once those are discussed, like in Ferguson, then people say, well, you know what, Michael Brown, he was actually charging the officer and this and that. But see, the media just kept 24/7, and that's the question that I asked. How much does 24/7 news really help or hinder race relations? And most people say it hinders it because all they do is focus on negative, focus on the point where somebody said, hands up, don't shoot. You still see that in protests right now, even though that was not the case. Our own Justice Department with Eric Holder said, no, that was not the case. You know, witnesses said that didn't happen. So it's because of the media type of bias that's out there. I don't think Donald Trump is helping a lot of times, or he didn't help in the past for some of his tweets and things that he does. But people probably got to get used to that because that's going to be the way he communicates. But I don't think that people, you know, sitting out the inauguration is another thing. I really think there's going to be a lot happening here in Washington, D.C. in a couple of days. So just for instance, there was people track donations to political candidates. 90% of all VA employees who donated to either Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, or Donald Trump donated to Hillary Clinton. 90%. Only 3% donated to Donald Trump. On the flip side, 30% of veterans said that they would even come close to supporting a Hillary Clinton candidacy. So you have a already built-in communications problem right there. The dynamic is already set. So, you know, those issues come up. And I think that, you know, things like white privilege and all that, those are there. But every time you go into a diversity class that some people teach across the country, the white elephant is always in the room. It's not anything that you're going to touch. Oh, we can't touch that. Even when I attempted to do this race relations dialogue last year in St. Louis, I got so much pushback from that. Oh, my goodness, you can't talk about race. And I said, well, what do you think a company would do if 70% of the people said their product was terrible? What would they do with that product? They would either get rid of it, try to correct it, redesign it, or something else, but they wouldn't ignore it. And so I finally got the secretary of the VA, Secretary McDonald, to buy off on it. And he says, yeah, this is something we did in Procter & Gamble. We need to do this. So that's
– So, okay, so let's talk about this because we talked about right before the show started, you and I talked a little bit. So I want you to explain what is it that you do exactly. You go to you visit different veterans offices across the country, and what do? Talk about that.
Well, I use a model that's called the World Cafe. It was created by Dr. Juanita Brown back in the 90s, and it's used by Fortune 5, Hewlett-Packard, and a lot of other places. You set up a setting, in a hospitable setting, basically, where you have tables, little settings that are placed on them. So when people come in, they feel very comfortable because it's something they've not come into in a class. Most diversity classes are mandatory. You have to go. You got to check the block. And believe me, you don't want to be in those. So now they're coming in. They volunteered to come to this. And we throw out, or I throw out, three different questions throughout a two-and-a-half-hour session. And the very first question that I said is, like, you know, why do we need to do this? And people will sit and talk for 20 minutes straight. And they'll outline things. This is why we need to do this. And they'll have, and every table has difference of what they think about what we need to address. But after the 20-minute session, then each table will have a person that reports out on what they discussed. And then after that happens, then everyone at their table switches to a completely different table. So now they're sitting with four other individuals that they haven't talked to before during the session. So we keep doing that, so they're getting cross-pollination of ideas on more advancing type of questions, like how does political correctness affect race relations? Would you rather have political correctness, or would you rather have straight talk with respect on talking about these issues? And for the most part, people will say they would rather have straight talk. So it's those type of questions that are out there. And then when other things are brought up, hey, we talked about the recent event in whatever city that it's in, all right? Or we talked about, you know, the election results and how it's affecting our families, how it's affecting people at work. And that's what we do. And then towards the end of the session, I ask them to do an action plan. What are you going to do from today forward in order to keep this dialogue going, be able to talk with your employees, develop more confidence, and then one of the things that I do for each facility is I make it a requirement that that facility director, and we have hospitals upwards of 8 to 10,000 employees, that somebody
wow.
there, more than one, is going to continue this dialogue and have this dialogue session once a quarter, once every 6 months, however that it is, so people aren't going to say, oh, they were just doing this because they are committed
right.
to this. So that's what I create. That's the plant, the seed that I plant out there. And, you know, it started in St. Louis last April. And when I said to the secretary, he asked me where I wanted to go, and I said St. Louis, and he says, wow, St. Louis. He said, I'd really like to jump in the arena. So I said, yeah, because if we can do it there, if we can open up, and that's what I call it, the gateway to race relations. And it worked out just extremely well. In fact, they've invited me back next month to go. So, but
all right,
you have
so right. So give us an example. What are some of the questions that you propose in this World Cafe type environment?
Well, as I said, the very first question is, we've all heard about we need a national conversation on race. Everybody and their brother has said that for decades. But let's start one. Let's have one. You know, all this. Nobody's ever created it. I said, why do we need one? Give me the top five reasons of why you think that having a national conversation on race would benefit you. Because the World Cafe is about each individual. It's not, and I said, I want to hear a lot of eyes. I think this way. I feel this way. I said, just as I cannot say that I can speak for every white male that's out there in the country, no one can speak for a race. And I said, or ethnicity. And I said, don't get focused on they think that or that. Just say, I think this way. And what does it mean to you? So people develop these lists at their table. They have a graphic representation of this so everybody can see, not only during the session, but afterwards when we paste them on the walls, about that is. And the second one that I normally go through is how do you think the effects of 24/7 media coverage on tragic events or election results or comments, quotes, or whatever, protests, how does that help or does it hinder race relations? Does it bring it to the forefront? You know, what can we do with that information that we hear all the time once something happens? So people do the same things, only they're doing it with different people now. So
right.
it's a dynamic that it's very, very, I guess, profound is the word that I've used. In my 27 years, I've never seen anything like it. I have had not one single negative comment from any of this. And any instructor out there, no matter what they teach, would love to have that feedback. So,
sure.
And it goes, you know, and it goes on, you know, to PC, and that's usually the most controversial topic is, you know, political correctness. Are we becoming too safe? Universities having safe zones? Hey, if you hurt my feelings. And most people will say, look, the definition of political correctness is so far advanced that nobody really knows what it is. It's like you can't
right.
say anything. So that
right.
actually stops you from talking about race.
And I think, you know, interestingly enough, I think that's one of the reasons that, Donald Trump stood out is because he wasn't about political correctness to everybody's shock and awe, right? I mean, he just said whatever he was thinking and it came out good, bad, or ugly, and there it was. And,
yeah, I can respect that. See, most people say that. Yeah. Even if you disagree with somebody or it just appalls you maybe at things that are said, at least you know where the person's coming from. You don't have to guess.
Right.
Because if they withhold it, then it's like, well, how does this person really think? So, yeah, I mean, he did open that up. That's for sure.
Well, so let me ask you this because we got about a minute left. So
sure.
If somebody wants to start this kind of dialogue, if somebody wants to – do this in their office or in their community, their school, whatever, how do they get started? You know, are there tips in your book? What should they do to get started?
Yeah, I think if they read some of the tips that I have in my book, Challenging Earth's America's Diversity Meltdown, Challenging Diversity Education and Its Epic Failure to Improve Race Relations, they would get a lot. They can also write me directly at challengingdiversity@gmail.com. Be glad to answer those questions. But one of the things that they really need to know is they're going to do this. They really need to have a trained facilitator and one that's actually experienced in the topic that they're trying to address there in race relations. We don't want anybody with agendas coming in or, you know, finger pointing and all that. This is a dialogue, not a debate. So that's some of the suggestions that I would have, is to have somebody that's experienced starting these out, and then have somebody as a backup that you can trust that can take these over.
I love what you said there, John, about this is not a debate, it's a conversation. It's an ongoing dialogue. It's not a win or lose, it's a dialogue.
Right. And that will make people feel safe, and that they'll be able to freely express their opinions at this table. They can also go to the worldcafe.com website to get more materials, and they're all free. So it's things that they can get, to how to set these up, hosting guides and all of that. So it's a good
deal.
Great.
Dr. John Fuller, thank you so much for stopping by. If you want to connect with Dr. John Fuller, if you have questions for him, you can reach out to him directly at challengingdiversity@gmail.com. And his book is available on Amazon. Look under Dr. John Fuller, or give us the title one more time, John.
Title is America's Diversity Meltdown: Challenging Diversity Education and Its Epic Failure to Improve Race Relations.
Dr. John Fuller, thank you so much.
And thank you. Talk again.
You bet. Good stuff there from Dr. John Fuller. And I just love the fact that his information shows that people are sick of the PC. PC is, you know, the political correctness has gone too far. We need to maybe reel that in a little bit. It's gotten so far out there that we don't even know what we're saying or how to say it. And also the fact that, again, this stuff, this racial discussion is that. It's a discussion, not a debate. We just have to keep moving forward. Good stuff there. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be talking about you and the internet with our next guest right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. My next guest, Kellen Kaltzman. Kellen Kaltzman owns Send It Rising Internet Marketing. He was the keynote speaker at Planet Hollywood in Las Vegas and has spoken at Roseman University. Kellen holds a master's degree in education and taught for 5 years before transitioning his career as an internet marketer. Kellen Kaltzman, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Pleasure to be here, Bert.
You bet. All right, so let's talk about this. Here you are. You are an educator. You're teaching school. And what made you go from being a teacher into being an internet marketer? Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So I was teaching Spanish and ESL. ESL is an acronym for English as a Second Language. And like many educators out there, I would come home, look at my paycheck, and cry a little bit. I ended up seeing a couple of websites. One was called Associated Content. The other was BrightHub. And they would allow whomever to write articles. And on the number of people that would view that article, you'd be paid passive income. And so
right.
I began writing lesson plans, ESL lesson plans, Spanish lesson plans, and I was getting about 1,000 views per month per article, which equated to $2 per month per article. So the idea was, okay, if I write 2,000 articles, I'll make about $4,000 a month in passive income. So I wrote hundreds and hundreds of articles on top of a full-time teaching gig. And in these articles, there was this little box that said SEO title and SEO description. Those were the meta title and meta description, which are fancy ways of saying the little blue link that appears in Google when you do a search,
right.
and the black text that appears beneath that. Those are your meta title and description. So this was my introduction to SEO, which is a large element of what we do now with my company, Send It Rising. So you know, I'm writing these articles, and then my wife and I are in Minnesota, and it is abysmally cold, as I'm sure you can imagine, and we decide to try out Las Vegas because at the time the economy was in its lowest, and the housing market had completely collapsed, and we figured now would be the time to take a big leap of faith, and we did. Ended up in Las Vegas, and I took a job for $9 an hour with a company called Advise Media Group as a blogger because I had had this blogging experience. Now, mind you, my student loan was $600 a month, and so that
wow.
$9 an hour gig wasn't gonna make ends meet. So I ended up taking naps in my car in between job one and job two. I taught adults, Spanish speakers, how to speak English at night. So I would do like an 8 to 4 and then a 6 to 9 for about a year there until I started growing with Advise Media Group. Flash forward 4 years, I'm a partner with Advise Media Group, and very recently, just this last September, I branched out on my own, but we're doing well. We've got 30 clients. I'm very happy. But the story that I like to tell is basically one in which, you know, we're going to find in short order the number of jobs being replaced by robots
mm-hmm.
to be increasing.
Right.
We're already chatting about that. And I'm interested in looking at solutions to what are we going to do with our time. Now, capitalism isn't going anywhere, nor should it. So we find ourselves at a crossroads between the amazing fact that, you know, a lot of these jobs that are just laborious and tedious are going to go towards the robots. And so what are we going to do? So here are two solutions that I have. The first is to understand that we're moving into a marketplace of attention. And Bert, you get that. You've got this show here. So you're making the right move. We're really going to be playing the game of who can get folks' attention to sell products XYZ. So understanding internet marketing is really important because each and every one of us now, whether we like it or not, has a brand. We have X number of Facebook friends, et cetera. And the other piece that I'm really trying to move forward in 2017 specifically is cause marketing. I would like the major players in the game to understand the difference between two Facebook posts, hypothetically. The first is a standard Facebook post. Hi, this is our business. This is our product. This is why you should buy from us. That's great, but it's not interesting. The second post is, hi, this is the company, and this is us at the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Awareness Run. Here are 30 pictures of us and our employees enjoying this particular event. The second post is going to be a much better advertisement, and I know it sounds cynical to talk about philanthropy and marketing in the same sentence, but we're going to have to find a way to simultaneously make the world a better place while still employing people, having them do good things in the community, building trust, and getting people's attention. People don't need us to tell them about our products all day, every day. They really don't. And the millennial generation and younger are looking for companies that care. That's going to be a driving decision. So in the generations that follow, I would really like there to be one more step added to our buying decisions. It's price, it's how good the product is, but it's also an understanding of what that company is doing philanthropically.
Right, right. Well, and I think the model has been proven. I mean, Tom's Shoes, isn't that cause marketing?
Yep, it absolutely is. You buy a pair of shoes from us, and we'll donate a pair of shoes, and they've done exceptionally well because they understand that, you know, each and every one of us has our own show, and it's our Facebook page. And if you can get someone to share on their Facebook page, then by all means. There's the cause marketing aspect. The other aspect is just autonomy and our need for freedom in our lives. And if you understand internet marketing and are able to create, let's say, a WordPress website.
Right.
For those of you that are unfamiliar, WordPress is it's basically the equivalent of Microsoft Word. You don't need to know code. It's quite simple once you've dug in. But if you can create a WordPress website, say, on top of your 9-to-5 and slowly begin the process of growing an audience and getting a little bit of passive income, then you'll later in life have an option as what it is you want to do. And I think as time progresses, the folks that have those secondary sources of income are going to feel a lot more liberated in how they can choose to live their life.
Yeah, I like it. So I want to back up because I want everybody to kind of go through this. I love this story. So here you are. You have a full-time job, and you start making a whopping $2 a month from your blog. Is that correct?
So $2 a month on average per article that I was writing.
Per article. Thank you. And so you have a couple of articles, and so the reason I want to break this down is because somebody may listen to this and say, "Wow, $2, that's not even worth my time." And in one sense, it's not, because it probably took you several hours and maybe you did a little research. And bottom line is, you spent probably more time developing that article, and now you're just getting $2 for it
per month.
Right. And this is the difference of the mindset. You see this as an opportunity to change your income, to change your livelihood, because you're looking at it as a passive income method, right? So here's a way to reach my goal, $2 per month per article. Somebody would look at it and say, "Wow, that's ridiculous. I would never do that." Meanwhile, fast forward 4, 5, 10 years later, the guy or the girl who has the wrong mindset is still working at a job they hate. Meanwhile, you have now thousands of dollars of passive income, and you're on a career path that you love.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, just as people, most of us, we want freedom. And, you know, I'm willing to pay a pretty hefty price to get it. And if you look at, if you have kids, I've got a couple kids. I mean, if you want to buy a year of your own life, that's expensive. And
yeah.
So, you know, anything we can do to get that monthly income coming in, we're going to do. And so, you know, what we've transitioned this entire blogging idea from our own personal blogs to that of companies, which gets me to the second piece of the equation, which is search engine optimization for businesses. You know, I'm not sure how much of your audience are small business owners or entrepreneurs, but, you know, if you look at the potential return on investment of an SEO program, you're going to have wildly different results based on the business itself. And a lot of businesses will look at something like SEO and blogging as the panacea, as exactly what they need to do. They just haven't found the right provider yet. And the
right
difference between me and a, you know, just a generic whatever SEO company is that I turn away about half the folks that come to me and say, "Oh, we need to do SEO," or "I hired someone before and they didn't know what they were doing, and so you seem like you know what you're doing, so let's just go with you and try it again." A good example is a friend of mine, Eric Kellish, with Property Management Inc. of Southern Nevada. He is our property manager for a property in North Las Vegas. Anyway, he says, "Hey, Kellen, you know, I hired an SEO company last year. They didn't really, you know, do well. What can you do for me?" I look at what he has. He has one page on a corporate website that he doesn't own, and I can't blog on it. So my answer to Eric was, "Nothing, Eric. I don't want your money, because you're just throwing it down the tube. It's not going to work." And he
right
said, "Well, I wish someone would have told me that before last year I spent $600 a month on an SEO company that just cashed a check." So the ignorance of our industry and how it works is pervasive, and it drives me crazy. And it's one of the reasons why I like doing shows like this, just so I can get the word out and let people know that you really have to understand how SEO works before you even consider paying someone, because they may just cash a check.
Absolutely. Well, here's the deal. Look, and I don't know why people don't get this. When you or I go on the internet, and when I say you and I, I'm talking general. Look, when us as people go on the internet, we're not looking necessarily for a specific website. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you're starting an internet search. You are saying, hey, how do I lose weight? Hey, how do I make money online? How do I do this? You know, most people are typing in some type of question, right? They're looking for an answer. And guess what? I don't know anybody who lands on a page that has, you know, whatever, 1,000 links pointing to it. They're landing on a page that has useful, relevant content, right, that the search engine has said this content is relevant to this search term, right? And that is how the internet works. That's how real SEO works. It is based on the content that is on your website, and you correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, to begin even the start of the process of how complicated this is will make your head spin. In 2015, Google rolled out something called RankBrain, which is artificial intelligence. The first global artificial intelligence, as far as I'm aware, and nobody seemed to care at all. It made no difference because nobody sees it. Nobody really understands
right.
it. And so how a website appears in search, according to Google, in 2017, is they look at content, which includes words, photos, videos on a page. Links would be the second, the number of links that point to the website. And the third is this artificial intelligence, RankBrain. So the takeaway, without you know talking about algorithms, is that if we do not provide evidence of our life and our business online, then we're not providing this artificial intelligence with what it needs to judge us positively. So, for example, what we're doing in this very moment is internet marketing. If I go out to an event, I should take 5 to 10 pictures. Those pictures should go on Pinterest, and I should create a blog post about that event, even if it's 20 words. Hi, I went to XYZ event. Here are the pictures of the event. When you name the pictures, you know, name them things like, you know, for me it would be an SEO event or an internet marketing event, .jpg. So you're giving this artificial intelligence all the evidence it needs to go, oh, I get it. This particular company is about internet marketing. And the same is true of videos. When I talk to business owners or get them onto our client roster, I say about half of the work are things that we can do. Half of it are things that we cannot do. We're not talking to your clients, so we can't ask them for Google reviews, for example. I can't bring your employees out to an event and take a lot of pictures. I can't take a video of you, let's say, you know, moving someone's furniture if you're a moving company or whatever that happens to be. And the business owners tend to think of their media as having to be perfect, which is ludicrous.
Right.
If you look at younger and younger folks, what you'll realize is the bar of perfection gets lower and lower and lower. The younger you are, the less you care about how perfect that video is. You know, look at like 15, 16-year-olds. They're sharing videos of whatever, just random stuff that we would think is crazy. But that's how the culture is shifting. And so it's okay if you're a bit older and it makes you uncomfortable, but you have to find a way to push through that and really think of yourself as owning a media company and start to produce content. As an example, we have a garage door repair client. I say, when you go out and there's a squeaky garage door, give me a before and after video. They're like, well, how do we shoot it? Do we have to buy a camera? I'm like, no, take your phone out of your pocket, point it at the garage door, before and after, thank you. We edit it. We put their little logo in front. Ta-da, like, great. We're not going to spend thousands of dollars running this commercial on TV. It's going on your YouTube channel. But we need
right.
that evidence, and it creates a backlink to the site, and then they rank in Google, and that's what makes the phone ring.
Yes, yes. And so in case people are wondering, you know, and this is something I've been saying, so I'm so happy to have you on the show. I've been telling people for years, forget SEO and just concentrate on building content, and it's got to be good content. I love your idea about the pictures, naming your pictures with specific things like – you know, squeaky garage door or something
mm-hmm.
like that makes a lot of sense. And I did not know about Rank Brain, and so I love this idea of thinking about this artificial intelligence looking at your website, and if it's not completely, labeled out, you know, then it can't really see it. And so I love this idea, and I love the idea of, again, as you're saying, which is what I believe, build the content. It's all about the content. And you know what? FedEx, by the way, if anybody has an Instagram account, FedEx is one of the companies I've been touting about, because, you know, when you think that you have nothing that you can say, right, such as a squeaky garage door, you know, what can you say about FedEx? First of all, they're already internationally well known. And second of all, it's FedEx delivering a package. I mean, I can't think of anything more mundane than, hey, here's FedEx delivering a package. Mm-hmm. So, but what they do is they take pictures of their FedEx trucks in iconic locations. They'll take funny pictures of different things. A FedEx truck, against a funny billboard or something like that. And it's, again, kind of what you said. They're not going out there in your face saying, hey, look at my FedEx truck, or buy more FedEx. They're saying, hey, we found this funny billboard, check it out. And there's the billboard, and 9 out of 10 times underneath the billboard is a FedEx truck. And
yeah,
so,
I absolutely love it.
Yeah, so you can be as creative as you want, and I'm inspired by what you said about the younger generation cares less and less about imperfection. So with that thought, if you're not sure what you can be creative about, get a 12-year-old to help you be creative, because I guarantee a 12-year-old will take a squeaky garage door and make fun with it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We take ourselves too seriously, and mm-hmm. I know I'm speaking to a broad audience, so the businesses are going to range, but imagine for a second you're in that meeting in FedEx corporate conference room, stodgy, the whole nine yards, and you're pitching this idea. Guys, what if we just, under billboards, take pictures? And everyone going, no, that's stupid. It's not, like, what about our brand image, blah, blah, blah. You see what I'm saying? And they finally say, okay, they capitulate and go, whatever. And then the metrics come in and they go, okay, fine, you're right. The same is absolutely true for small and mid-sized businesses. I like to always have a side project because when I am hired by a client, I tend to be more conservative. I will take risks all day, every day with my own business and with my side project, especially. And so I have a side project called WhatEveryDogDeserves.com. We sell rescue ties. They're these cute little ties and bow ties for $10, and then we donate to help rescue dogs, right? And
right.
We took stock imagery of dogs and created these dumb little Pinterest images. For example, imagine a corgi, which is a small little burrito-shaped dog, trying to get up a stair. And it says, life is short, so are my legs. And on Pinterest, that image got repinned 24,000 times.
Wow.
And so, right. And so 24,000 backlinks to a blog post on my website is going to have us rank much better. Hence, we save more dogs. And then the messaging is that of, hey, we're rescuing dogs, help us help them. And it creates a virtuous cycle. So, that image and the reaction it elicited from you is, it's common. People chuckle, they laugh. That's the point. And so I know it's not cute, fuzzy dogs all of the time. You may run an incredibly serious, personal injury attorney, level company. So you have to be delicate. But as another example of something that's less sexy or less interesting would be a landscaping rock company that we work for here in the Valley, in the Las Vegas Valley. He sells rocks. And we went on Pinterest, and this picture that got 12,000 repins is the most mundane, dumb picture of three patio pavers leading up to a fence surrounded by rocks. It doesn't look pretty. There's nothing special about it. If you'd have lined up 100 photos, I never would have picked it, ever. And that's the one that got 12,000 repins. And I don't know why.
Wow.
But it's okay.
That's funny.
So the point is that you don't always know what's going to work. You have to put yourself out there, and you have to get rid of that perfectionist in you.
Yes, yes. And you know what? Back to the personal injury attorney, back
sure.
to the plastic surgeon. There's always something out there. And if you don't know how to do it, find somebody to be creative about it. For example, there are tons of attorney jokes. And
oh, yeah.
People,
yeah.
I mean, look, and don't we all love and respect somebody, even admire them when they can kind of make themselves, when they, as you said, don't take themselves too serious and make fun of themselves,
right?
Self-deprecating
humor.
Self-deprecating humor works. It's intoxicating. And you know what? You could literally have an attorney, a very stuffy attorney with a suit and tie, do a video, very monotone, and I could see him do a series of attorney jokes.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
I mean, right there, man. We just, you know, a law firm listening to this now just made tens of thousands of dollars for free because of us.
Yeah, just send us the check.
Yeah, or at least give us the credit.
Yeah, we'll take that. Or a link.
Yeah, a link. There you go, a link. Pay us in a couple of links. So my point being is, you know, if you're an attorney, a personal injury attorney, a surgeon, you know, yes, you got to write about your industry, and yes, you got to write about insurance, and yes, you got to write about maybe your trends, but being humorous works, being deprecating works, being creative works. And I think it also helps, by the way, when you know your audience. And so that is another reason maybe to survey your list and find out, you know, what movies are they watching? What do they think is hot? What do they think it's not? I mean, you know, all this other stuff. It's good to get in contact with your audience and find out what they're thinking, because this will help you direct your creativity.
Yeah, it's, you know, if there's one thing I could magically do with all of my clients, it would be for them to get over their fear of the camera.
Yes.
You know, it really would be amazing. And to your listeners, if you got a second, type in Send It Rising into YouTube and find our YouTube channel and subscribe. I told myself, okay, I am going to create a video every week, every Friday, no matter what. And I have had a blast doing this. It is probably the most fun I have all week because I'm flexing that creative muscle on something, you know, that is truly my own. And so I think for a lot of folks, they stand in front of a camera and they go, all of these fears and anxieties that they thought they left in middle school come rushing right back in. You know, not everyone is comfortable doing radio shows and this kind of thing, but the adrenaline, the dopamine, the whole nine yards, the experience of it, it's truly something that I wish everyone would, if they're feeling that fear, and especially if you're a business owner, just because if I were to, for example, go to my personal injury attorney client and say, here's this brilliant idea, you know, we came up with Bert and I on the radio today, he would go, ha, 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 no.
Yeah.
Right, he goes, yep, no way, no chance. I may yeah. still bring it up, you know. But if I can at least get him in front of the camera at all, you know, even if it's with the 72 books behind him, leather-bound books, you know, and like a fern in the corner, and just talk to your audience, please, I'm begging you. Because they've got incredible things that they're doing. They do do work with basically like mock trials. They're not afraid of going to trials. There's all these interesting facts about them that if I write them down, nobody's going to read it. Nobody cares. I can put them in huge lettering on the homepage. Yeah, it might help with conversions a little bit, but him looking, you know, right into the camera and saying, you know, here are three stories about, you know, things that have occurred and this is what makes us different, is going to have way more legs. And then not to mention YouTube, believe it or not, Bert, can actually read and understand English. So when you talk
yes.
in a video, the artificial intelligence is now picking that up, and it's counting as content. So think, how long would this transcript be of our interview? Probably, I don't know, 2,000 words so far or more.
Right.
that's a huge article. And so that's really the next step is trying to get folks past that fear and into content creation mode.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, I'd love to bring you back and talk more. You know, Kellen, I've had a blast with you today, and unfortunately we're out of time, but I would love to bring you back and talk more about SEO, the real SEO, how to build content, how to be more creative. Maybe we can bring you back and we can do a whole episode on YouTube and stuff like that. If you guys want to find out more about Kellen and his crew, you can go to senditrising.com, senditrising.com. Kellen Kausman, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thanks, Bert.
Good stuff there. Just a lot of fun. I hope that you guys got a lot out of it, man. And if you do some of the stuff that Kellen and I talked about, you can see where it'll double, triple, quadruple your traffic, make you the expert and the fun person to go to in your industry. So make it happen. Senditrising.com. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.